Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. U.S. and European stocks surged Tuesday, rebounding from the huge sell-off in recent days, even as China led another slump in Asian markets. New York markets jumped 2% in midday trading. Key stock averages in Europe ended even higher, with the Frankfurt market closing ahead 5%. But Shanghai plummeted 7.6%. Its main index dropped sharply when the market opened, but then rebounded at one point to being down about 4%. As shares fell again in the afternoon, markets in Japan and Hong Kong that had rallied to gains also saw sell-offs. Japan's Nikkei index closed down about 4%, while Hong Kong Hang Seng rallied in the final hour to push just ahead in positive territory. Authorities in Spain and Morocco arrested 14 people Tuesday they say were part of a network to recruit fighters to join the Islamic State group in Iraq and Syria. Spain's Interior Ministry said the arrest took place in San Martin de la Vega, just south of Madrid, and in five locations in northern Morocco. The ministry did not give further details about those arrested and their alleged activities. Record numbers of migrants are entering Hungary, officials said Tuesday, as well as arriving in many other parts of Europe. The UN Refugee Agency is calling on all governments to respond compassionately to this human tide of people who have been displaced from their homelands and are now seeking safety. Hungary has registered more than 100,000 migrants in 2015, more than double the number from last year. Authorities said nearly 2,100 crossed the border Monday. That is the highest number to do so in a single day. This is VOA News. A Russian military court Tuesday sentenced acclaimed Ukrainian film director Oleh Sentsov to 20 years in prison on charges of leading a terrorist group in Crimea. Rights groups say the case shows every sign of being a politically motivated show trial because of his opposition to Russia's occupation of Crimea. VOA's Daniel Scharf reports from Moscow.
A military court in Rostov-on-Don found Oleg Sentsov guilty of leading a terrorist group and terrorist attacks on pro-Russia organizations in Crimea. Co-defendant Oleksandr Kolchenko was also convicted of terrorism and sentenced to 10 years. Rights groups expected a guilty verdict in the highly politicized trial. Heather McGill is a researcher in Amnesty International's Eurasia program.
The various violations of fair trial standards point to the fact that these accusations are possibly fabricated for political reasons.
Russia's FSB arrested Sentsov in May 2014 at a pro-Ukraine rally in Crimea. The Ukrainian director is best known for his 2011 film Gamer, about a teenage computer games champion. International filmmakers have called for his release. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Moscow.
South Sudanese President Salva Kiir has agreed to sign a peace deal aimed at ending his country's 20-month-old civil war. In a letter obtained by VOA South Sudan In Focus program, the East African Bloc, IGAD, says the agreement will be signed Wednesday in Juba, South Sudan's capital. The United States has threatened sanctions against leaders on both sides of the conflict unless they make progress toward ending the war. The conflict has displaced an estimated 2.2 million South Sudanese from their homes. Turkey will hold snap parliamentary elections on November 1st. The chairman of the country's election board announced Tuesday. The announcement came a day after President Recep Tayyip Erdogan formally asked for a new parliamentary vote. Mr. Erdogan's Justice and Development Party, the AKP, lost its parliamentary majority in June for the first time since 2002, and 2 months of talks with the opposition to form a ruling coalition proved unsuccessful. Also Tuesday, Mr. Erdogan asked Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoglu to form a temporary cabinet ahead of the November vote. Photos posted online by Islamic State on Tuesday claimed to show the destruction of a 2,000-year-old temple at the Syrian World Heritage Site of Palmyra early this week. In the series of images, several men carried barrels into the Roman-era Baal Shaman Temple, lining the base and placing the containers connected by blue wires on columns. Other photos show a cloud of smoke and debris and dust-covered hunks of rubble, presumably in the aftermath of Sunday's explosion. UNESCO called the temple's destruction a war crime. I'm Bob Doty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The UN High Commissioner for Refugees says nearly 300,000 refugees and migrants have arrived in Europe across the Mediterranean Sea this year. Most went to Italy and Greece. The UNHCR warns the situation is not sustainable and is calling for a comprehensive solution.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva. Details coming up. Also in the news, United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says better government would help Nigeria combat Boko Haram insurgents who have ravaged much of the country's northeast. And South Sudanese President Salva Kiir has agreed to sign a peace deal aimed at ending his country's 20-month-old civil war. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says better government would help Nigeria combat Boko Haram insurgents who have ravaged much of the northeast. Chris Stein reports from Lagos.
In a speech Monday in the capital Abuja, Mr. Ban drew a parallel between the bloody civil war in Syria and Nigeria's own struggle against insecurity.
The 5 years war in Syria has started from this lack of good governance, because the leaders have not been paying attention. They were not speaking with the people. It has given perfect breeding ground for extremism to take root. We have to prevent this one.
Mr. Ban's two-day visit marked the fourth anniversary of the August 27th, 2011 bombing of the UN facility in Abuja. At least 23 people were killed and 60 injured in the attack. It was the first major bombing of any international organization in Nigeria. The UN chief's visit comes less than 3 months after Muhammadu Buhari took office as Nigeria's president. Observers credited his election victory in part to voter dissatisfaction with the previous government's handling of Boko Haram. Mr. Ban said the UN would support Nigeria in its fight against the Islamic extremists, and reiterated calls for the release of more than 200 schoolgirls abducted by Boko Haram from the northeastern town of Chibok last year.
I once again call in the strongest possible terms on those responsible to unconditionally release these girls and many other abducted children.
President Buhari has pledged to wean Nigeria off its dependence on oil exports, revitalize the agriculture sector, and solve the country's massive unemployment problem. Mr. Ban linked the success of Africa's most populous country in fighting insecurity and corruption and providing employment to the continent's success as a whole.
I'm convinced that when you change Nigeria, you also change Africa.
Mr. Buhari is expected to travel to New York next month for the UN General Assembly. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
In other Nigeria news, two suicide bombers attacked civilians in a bus station in northern Nigeria today. The first bomber killed five and wounded more than 40 in a bus station in Damaturu. The second bomber's explosives detonated prematurely. He was the only one fatality in that explosion. Witnesses to the attack on the bus station described the bomber as a young girl about 14 years of age. When community home guards tried to prevent her entry to the station, she struggled free and exploded her device. Damaturu is a city of 44,000 in Yobe State, one of three states often targeted by Boko Haram gunmen and bombers in the past 6 years. South Sudanese President Salva Kiir has agreed to sign a peace deal aimed at ending his country's 20-month-old civil war. In a letter obtained by VOA's South Sudan in Focus program, the East African bloc IGAD says the agreement will be signed tomorrow in Juba, South Sudan's capital. IGAD has been mediating talks to end the war between Mr. Kiir's government and rebels led by his former deputy, Riek Machar. Machar signed the agreement in Addis Ababa on August 17th, but the South Sudanese Turkey's president refused, saying that peace under the deal could not be sustained. The United States has threatened sanctions against leaders on both sides of the conflict unless they make progress towards ending the war. The French news agency quotes a spokesman for Mr. Kiera saying the government still has reservations about the deal. Even if Mr. Kiera signs it, Mr. Kiera objects to power-sharing provisions like calls to demilitarize Juba and seeing foreigners in charge of a commission that would monitor implementation of the deal. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees says nearly 300,000 refugees and migrants have arrived in Europe across the Mediterranean Sea this year. Most went to Italy and Greece. The UNHCR warns the situation is not sustainable and is calling for a comprehensive solution. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says the chaotic scenes of thousands of desperate people trying to enter the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia over the weekend has calmed. But it warns the flight of these desperate people is continuing and is unstoppable. UNHCR spokeswoman Melissa Fleming says people are coming in groups of 300 to 400. Monitors at the Macedonian border say up to 3,000 asylum seekers are arriving every day, most fleeing violence and conflict in Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Fleming says the refugees and migrants, among them many vulnerable women, children, and elderly, are in very poor condition when they arrive.
They're often physically exhausted, they're psychologically traumatized, and very often in need of humanitarian medical assistance. So it's vital that these people are treated humanely, also that essential assistance is provided.
Once they have rested, the refugees and migrants head for Serbia, cross into Hungary, and move on to other countries in the European Union. The UNHCR reports Germany and Sweden accept around 43% of the asylum seekers. Germany recently said it expected around 800,000 to arrive this year. Fleming says this situation is not sustainable and cannot be solved by any one country working alone. She says there has to be a more decent and equitable distribution of these desperate people among the 28-member European Union. She tells VOA a recent plan by the EU to distribute 40,000 refugees among EU member countries has yet to be implemented. While this will not solve the problem, she says it is a good beginning. She adds the Dublin Agreement, which sets out rules for examining asylum claims, also has some measures which allow for better distribution, but they are not being implemented properly.
That is that if somebody claims asylum in one country but has strong ties to another, and many people seeking asylum are headed for countries in which they have ties, they're either their family members or they speak the language, their communities, that a transfer of their application could take place. So that could be strengthened.
The UNHCR is calling for legal avenues, such as more resettlement opportunities and more student and work visas, so people do not have to undertake these perilous journeys. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In more news of migrations to Europe, the Hungarian government plans to finish construction of a 3.5-meter high barbed wire fence along its border with Serbia. The fence is meant to discourage migrants from entering the European Union. Hungary is a frontline EU state for thousands of Syrians and other migrants making their way from Turkey through Greece, Macedonia, and Serbia. In related news, the UN Refugee Agency says it's been able to deliver aid to tens of thousands of displaced people in Libya. The UNHCR has distributed aid around Tripoli and in the southern part of the country, despite heavy fighting. However, thousands more displaced people are still in need of assistance. Leo Dobbs is a spokesman for the UNHCR. From Geneva, he spoke to VOA's Jody Capua about humanitarian operations in Libya.
Libya has been torn by fighting for quite some months now. And in the south, it's flared up since the middle of July. Some people have been displaced, 7,500 people displaced, and many people are in need of aid. We've managed to deliver aid to 8,810 people in and around the southern cities of Sabah and Arbery, despite the fighting, the fiercest in that area and across the south since May 2014, when this current wave of fighting began.
How has UNHCR been able to deliver aid when fighting was going on?
Well, we've been delivering aid through local partners. Our international staff were evacuated earlier this year from Tripoli. Our local staff are still working in organization. We work through local partners, doing so during a lull in the fighting in Sabah, for example, where there's been street fighting, so it's very tough. But in the southwest, in the town of Kufra, where there's also been a lot of fighting, a tribal fighting, we have been unable to deliver aid because of the security problems. In fact, in Sabah, we had hoped to reach 15,000 people, but only reached 8,800 because the insecurity made it impossible to reach everyone.
Now, your agency describes the Kufra area as a major transit point in the southeast for goods and people being smuggled from sub-Saharan Africa. I assume they're being smuggled from the continent across the Mediterranean to Europe?
A lot of the people who have been trying to reach Europe do come from countries in sub-Saharan Africa. They pass through Sudan and they come from the Horn of Africa, and they make their way across the desert coming into Libya. And Kufra is in the south, and people pass through there. So to reach Libya's Mediterranean coast, people need to go through that area. So there's fighting, mainly tribal fighting in that area, as it seems as though it took control of the area. But this has forced, in the past month, more than 700 people to flee to neighboring areas. And these people are in desperate need of help, and that's why we're quite keen to find ways to help them as soon as possible. And we're calling on all sides to provide humanitarian access to people across the south and other areas of the country where there's fighting, including the east.
Besides the fighting between the various tribal groups, you also say there is fighting between the Libya Dawn militia and supporters of the late Muammar Gaddafi.
That's right. There's been fighting in the city of Sabah, which is a city of 90,000 people. This flared earlier in August. It seems to have quietened down in the past week, but there's also been fighting in the town of Sirte between IS and tribal groups there as well.
Do you have any idea how many people within Libya have been displaced by fighting between various groups?
Our estimate for the number of internally displaced people, those who have fled their homes and sought shelter in other parts of the country, we estimate that there are more than 400,000 IDPs now. A lot of them need help, and we've been trying, and we continue to try to reach those people.
Any idea how many of the 400,000 you have been able to reach?
Probably about 60,000 this year. We will try to continue to help others when and where we can. And then, of course, there are some refugees who are our main people of concern.
Do any of the refugees say they would like to go back home instead of trying to pass through Libya to Europe?
I think ultimately all refugees would like to go home. I think that when most of the people fled to Libya, it was a country at relative peace, and things have deteriorated since.
Leo Dobbs is a spokesman for the UNHCR. From Geneva, he spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua. You are listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Nineteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says better government would help Nigeria combat Boko Haram insurgents who have ravaged much of the northeast. And South Sudanese President Salva Kiir has agreed to sign a peace deal aimed at ending his country's 20-month-old civil war. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. B Burundi's President Pierre Nkurunziza was sworn in for a third term last Thursday as critics continue to accuse him of hijacking democracy by breaking term limits in the nation's constitution. In taking the oath of office, Mr. Nkurunziza swore to uphold the constitution and defend the best interests of the Burundian nation. But critics say this won't resolve the political crisis in Burundi. Mariama Diallo looks at the situation and has this report.
Moi, Pierre Nkurunziza, président de la République du Burundi, je jure.
John Baku, author of many books on democracy and political transition in Africa, says Mr. Nkurunziza should take a number of steps to help bring the country together.
Number one, he has to form a government of national unity, some government that represents all the factions within the country, not just members of his political party or his ethnic group. The second thing he needs to do is to stop demonizing the opposition, using his born-again status to condemn anybody who opposes him.
Stephanie Schwartz is with the U.S. Institute for Peace.
An inauguration doesn't mean that the crisis is over. The state of affairs in turn has not changed. There had been sort of moving towards some sort of mediation process in July, and that hasn't really gone anywhere. But certainly this crisis will not be resolved without some sort of political dialogue.
Baku says without peace, Mr. Nkurunziza will not be able to move the country forward.
He needs to figure a way to put together a constitution that is relevant to the country's history, the country's realities, the country's problems, so that they will have within the country a set of laws and institutions that can help the people of Burundi live together peacefully.
Burundi has been plagued by violence since Mr. Nkurunziza announced his candidacy for a third term that many insist is illegal. The UN Refugee Agency says about 180,000 people have recently fled the country. In his inauguration, Mr. Nkurunziza pleaded for their return. But Schwartz says it won't be easy.
The return of refugees from external countries is not just a humanitarian issue. It's not just a logistic issue. It's a potential conflict dynamic. And the conflicts at the local level in Burundi before the crisis have always been about issues between returnees and those who stayed over land. And that's still going to be a serious issue for Burundi as we continue to look to the future.
A report by Amnesty International accuses Burundian security agencies of detaining and torturing anti-government protesters. Burundian officials were not available for comment. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
Pest experts from across Africa have recommended vast vaccination and pest eradication programs to stop transborder animal diseases that claim between 10 and 20% of the continent's animals yearly. The experts are gathered in the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé, under the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization's program. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon Livestock Minister Dr. Tiger says pests such as sheep, nose boat files, stomach worms, wool maggots, lice and ticks are causing havoc on animals in some communities in his country.
La peste de petit ruminant est une maladie qui décime près de 100% du cheptel quand il.
He says all animals in an environment can be killed if one animal is affected, because the diseases are highly contagious, and that is why the Food and Agriculture Organization and the World Organization for Animal Health are teaming up and gathering all countries to eradicate the diseases. He says when Central African countries succeed in eradicating the pests, they will be able to provide better quality protein to their populations. Dr. Sebastien Mongomo, animal pest expert from Equatorial Guinea, says diseases caused by the pests have claimed at least 10% of sheep and goats in his country this year.
Entre le Gabon et le Cameroun et la Guinée équatoriale, plusieurs entrées sont pas.
He says the borders between Cameroon, Gabon and Equatorial Guinea are very porous and it is difficult to control the movement of animals. Symptoms of the pest vary from minor itching and irritation to extreme annoyance and fatigue, malnutrition, and then death. Pests also can rapidly transmit diseases and cause secondary infections. Dr. Felix Njimi, animal health officer of the Food and Agriculture Organization, says the losses are aggravating the food crisis, especially in sub-Saharan African countries.
The strategy is the large mass vaccination at the country level, undertake surveillance to detect any case of the disease, and strengthening collaboration between member nations and even between international institutions. Imagine somebody who has 10 animals and lose 8. The disease can have impact in food security.
Suzanne Monsterman of the World Organization for Animal Health says they have agreed to help African countries with funding for disease and pest control and surveillance programs.
The nature of our assistance is first and foremost to develop international strategies that can be used by Africa as well as, let's say, a country in Asia or a country in Eastern Europe affected by the disease. It's an international strategy which we are now going to translate into a national strategy. So the National Strategic Control Plan is a result of an international strategy.
Poor people in most African countries rely on goats and sheep for their livelihoods. The Food and Agriculture Organization reports that they become extremely vulnerable and are hit by famine when pests attack and kill their animals. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
And a safari guide was killed by a lion yesterday. This while leading tourists on a walking photographic tour of the Hwange National Park in Zimbabwe. The park gained international attention last month when an American dentist shot and killed Cecil the Lion, a popular attraction at Hwange. The government is seeking extradition of the American and has arrested others in the alleged crime. Quentin Swales was a 40-year-old guide employed by a safari company. He was leading a small group of tourists on the walk when he decided to follow traces of a pride of lions. A male lion unexpectedly charged Swales, who died of his injuries at a local medical facility. None of the tourists were injured. The 15,000 square kilometer park is an hour's drive south of Victoria Falls. This is African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
A message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Malaria kills thousands of people each year, but there are some simple things you can do to protect your family. If you can, put screens in your windows. A simple screen can keep disease-carrying mosquitoes out of your home. If you go outside, wear light-colored clothing and long pants and long sleeves, especially when it is dark and mosquitoes are most active. After it rains, empty all containers of standing water. The water in just one discarded tire can become a breeding ground for thousands of mosquitoes. Make sure your home is clear of debris and anything that holds water, including discarded cans, water containers, and rubbish. Empty containers that livestock drink from regularly so that mosquitoes cannot breed there.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. South Sudanese President Salva Kiir has agreed to sign a peace deal aimed at ending his country's 20-month-old civil war. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees says nearly 300,000 refugees and migrants have arrived in Europe across the Mediterranean Sea this year. And the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says better government would help Nigeria combat Boko Haram insurgents who have ravaged much of the country's northeast. Coming up, music from Rwanda, and in our feature segment, human rights groups are putting new pressure on Senegal to change its abortion laws. I'm Yehi Suhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday, Yehias.
Sunny, what's the latest at the World's Athletics Championships?
Yehias, Tuesday marked the fourth day of competition at the World Championships in Athletics in Beijing, China. Kenya won gold medals in the men's 400 meters hurdles and the men's 800 meters races, while Ethiopia won gold in the women's 1,500-meter event. Genzeba Dibaba was the gold medalist in the 1,500 meters race, clocking 4 minutes and 8.09 seconds. Kenya's Faith Kipyegon won the silver medal, while Sifan Hassan of the Netherlands won the bronze. Gold medal winner Genzeba Dibaba is 24 years old, and she's the younger sister of Ethiopia's three-time Olympic champion, Tirunesh Dibaba. Genzeba has won world indoor titles over 1,500 meters and 3,000 meters, but this was the first time she's been crowned world champion outdoors. Last month at a meet in Monaco, Genzeba ran 3 minutes and 50.07 seconds for 1,500 meters, a new women's world record subject to ratification. Meanwhile, another African record holder, Kenya's David Rudisha, won his second world title Tuesday in the men's 800 meters final, clocking 1 minute 45.84 seconds. Adam Kizat of Poland won the silver medal, and Amal Tuka of Bosnia-Herzegovina won the bronze medal. Our VOA sports fans will remember Rudisha missed the 2013 World Championships in Moscow because of a knee injury. Rudisha's Kenyan teammate Nicholas Bett won his first world title in the men's 400 meters hurdles race. His time of 47.79 seconds was a personal best and the fastest time in the world this year. Denis Kudryavtsev of Russia won the silver medal, and Jeffrey Gibson of the Bahamas won the bronze. In action Monday in Beijing, Olympic champion Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce of Jamaica successfully defended her world title in the women's 100 meters final, clocking 10.76 seconds.
I believe in his will, you know, God's will, God's plan. And, you know, I really wanted to run a personal best tonight, but it wasn't to be. And, of course, the excitement of running races and being in front as it's you know, perks. And, of course, I think Stephen will have some say about that when I see him. But, I mean, I have a next race after this, so hopefully, you know, God's will and I can get it together and deliver. And hopefully I'll have a personal best. But if it wasn't to be tonight, it just wasn't to be. But, you know, I'm really excited that I came out here and I defended my title.
In defending her title, Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce became the first woman to win three 100-meter gold medals in the 32-year history of the World Championships.
I mean, I feel good, you know. For me, I'm from a place where persons, you know, attach stigmas and their names to. But to be able to rise above that and to become one of, you know, the top females in the world is an honor. And, you know, I guess what I would like to say, you know, it don't matter where you're from. You know, it don't matter your past or, you know, anything like that. It's about your future and your vision, you know, what you have in store for yourself and just believing in that and working towards that goal. And I think for me, it's triumphant every time I come out here and race because there's so much, you know, as a woman and as a successful woman you have to deal with, because I think sometimes people are intimidated by success and how successful you are. But for me, I mean, all the glory belongs to God. And, you know, there's this scripture that I remember today when I was sitting in my room, and it said, ears have not heard and eyes have not seen and minds have not conceived, you know, the plans that God have for those who trust him, you know, and have forever trusted him. And, you know, no matter what comes, you know, I'm always just focused on just, you know, doing my best and doing that year after year and working hard and just let the chips fall where they're me.
You might say the chips have fallen in gold medal winning fashion for Shelley Ann Fraser-Pryce. In addition to her two Olympic gold medals at 100 meters, the Jamaican star has now won 6 world titles, 3 at 100 meters, 1 at 200 meters, and 2 more gold in the 4x100-meter team relay. Shelley Ann won her first Olympic 100-meter title at the same Bird's Nest Stadium in Beijing 7 years ago. She reflects on her success over the years.
I mean, a couple of years ago, 2008, I had no idea I would even win a gold medal, you know, but who knows, you know. And I came out here tonight again, you know. When I came out here for the heats, I stood out here and I was like, I was here. You know, when I was here, I was 21 years old. I was young. I didn't expect anything. I know I'm grown, you know, just here and wanting to do it again. But, you know, for me, I kind of put that at the side because, as I said before, every championship is different. As you can see, the lineup was way different than it was before. And, you know, I just wanted to come out here and execute, you know, and it paid off. So I'm really excited that, you know, I get to lift the next championship.
World and Olympic champion Shelley Ann Fraser-Pryce married her boyfriend Jason Price 4 years ago. She credits her husband and more than a few others with helping her get to the top of the medals podium.
My husband, Jason, my family, my friends, you know, my mother, everybody, my brothers, you know, my coaching staff, management, every single person who played a part in making this a reality. You know, persons believe that when we are successful, we have done it by ourselves. But honestly, you know, if it wasn't for the persons who helped to get it done, you know, getting the equipment set up, getting, of course, my husband being the number one in everything, you know, taking care of Shelley Ann, you know, and of course my sponsors who continue to back me, you know, Grace Kennedy, Digicel, and of course Nike, for, you know, continuing to support Shelley Ann, you know, year after year. You know, last year was one of those years that didn't go according to plan, but for me, every year is a new year and you have to stick with it. You know, when it's hard, that is when the time you work. You know, when you're done, you keep working because, you know, your work is never in vain.
World and Olympic sprint champion Shelley Ann Fraser-Pryce speaking at the Bird's Nest Stadium in Beijing, China. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny. And my Twitter handle is @VOASunnySports. If you go to my Facebook page, you'll see some wonderful photos of Shelley Ann Fraser-Pryce. Shelley Ann ran to victory in Beijing with her hair braids dyed green and with sunflowers planted in her hair. In Shelley Ann's words, "I like bright colors. I like when I'm chirpy and happy in the lane. You know, I have my sunflowers, and I'm just a living, walking garden." I'll have more news from the World Athletics Championships. But first, Zimbabwe football is mourning the death of Willard Mashinkila Kumalo. Michael Cariotti reports from the capital, Harare.
Kumalo had Reinhard Fadlis' dream team that nearly qualified for the 1994 World Cup in the USA and featured for the team between 1992 and 1994, passed on in Mzilikazi at the age of 49 after struggling with diabetes for some time. He won the league title in countless knockout tournaments with the Islanders, playing alongside the likes of Madinda Ndlovu, the sixth Banda, Peter Nkomo, Titus Majola, Ernest Banda, amongst others. He later on moved to Germany, where he played for Bona SC in the third tier Bundesliga. Kumalo then turned into coaching, where he handled Highlanders, Lancia Steel, Mwana Africa, before moving to coach in Botswana. At the time of his death, Kumalo was welfare manager for his favorite team, Highlanders. Ernest Banda, popularly known as Matepa, pays tribute to Mawiwi, saying he went too early.
What he had put into Zimbabwe football, it's so sad. And, you know, if we have people like them passing in so early, it becomes so difficult. Those are the players who nearly took us to the World Cup.
Tragedy also struck Kumalo's Highlander side after they were beaten 1-0 by relegation threatened Flem Lily. Also, coach Bongani Mafu says it is saddening that this team did not give Kumalo a fitting tribute with a win.
True pity that we also did not win on the day that our legend passed away. So we are very, very sad as a family.
Reporting in Harare, this is Michael Cariotti.
Thanks, Michael. In more results from the World Championships in Athletics in Beijing, China, Cuba's Denise Caballero won the gold medal Tuesday in the women's discus with a throw of 69.28 meters. Sandra Perkovic of Croatia won the silver medal, and Nadine Muller of Germany won the bronze medal. In the men's long jump, Greg Rutherford of Britain was crowned world champion. Greg had a gold medal-winning leap of 8.41 meters. Fabrice Lapierre of Australia won the silver medal, and local favorite Janan Wang of China won the bronze medal. After 4 days of competition, Kenya continues to top the medals table. The Kenyans have a total of 9 medals, 4 gold, 3 silver, and 2 bronze. Britain is next on the table with 3 gold medals. Shelly Ann Fraser Price's Jamaica is 3rd on the table with 2 gold and 1 bronze and 3 medals. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to you, Hayes Wuhi.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sun in an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, cholera cases in South Sudan. And next, human rights groups putting new pressure on Senegal to change its abortion laws. But first, some music. Here is Mani Martin from Rwanda with Yoba Yoba.
Yara dufite turabunzu kuru batatu twibera mu mataba twiragira inkazi wacu akadukamira yera tukanywa tukanyurwa tukitetera umukuru muri twe akabinajorwa umukurikiye akabinarumikwa nanjye umuto muri bo maze kuba umugabo udaterwa kundi mwana waje nge
Yoba yoba, mwana wa mama tuwe mmoja. dutangira kuryana byato nato bazo tubonye bikamurenga bikamuyobera bikamushobera sogokuru yaje kuducira umugani nako n'umufindo mbambaroga afata inkoni eshatu arazibangikanya azibohesha umurungu ukomeye ati bana banjye mumaze kuba abagabo ngaho nimuvunaguriza inkoni ndewa bana banjye uburiza muri twe arazisingira zimunaniye azikikiriza ubuheta nanjye uyeture nizana nkwereke ahari aho dufatanije twazivunagura inkoni zitubera ibamba ziratunanira azifata azikuraho wa murunga arazikonyagura imwe ku yindi dukora tugira tumumaze kubona abana banjye nimuguma hamwe ntawe uzabatera nimuguma kuryana bazabavunagura nk'izi nkoni
Manny Martin from Rwanda with Yoba Yoba. More than 40 people have died from cholera cases since South Sudanese health officials declared an outbreak in several locations, including Juba. As Philip Tonaliu reports from the capital, avoiding contaminated food and drinking clean water remains a challenge for many residents who are struggling to feed their families.
For two people have died, and a total of 1,399 cholera cases have been reported in Juba and Bor, according to the World Health Organization and the Ministry of Health this year. 41 of the 42 deaths were from Seven Payams in Juba. The other death was from Malo in Makwai Payam of Bor County. Of the 42 deaths, six are children under the age of 5 years, according to UNICEF. In response to the crisis, government and health partners, including MSF, the French acronyms for Doctors Without Borders, increased the number of temporary cholera treatment centers, or CTCs. The Munuki Center just opened 2 weeks ago. It is divided into three sections, including intensive care, hospitalization, and recovery units. A 7-year-old girl is among the 42 confirmed cases at the center. She is the daughter of an anxious parent named Monica, who preferred not to use her last name.
This disease is very serious. I stayed awake up to 5 o'clock in the morning thinking my child will die. But today, she is able to sit on her own.
But Monica says not everyone in her neighborhood has been as lucky. She says some families she knows lost their loved ones. At the Munuki Center, Jessica Yohana sits up in her bed in the recovery unit. Yohana says the new center is only a stone's throw away from her home. In the first, she says, cholera patients had traveled long distances to receive treatment.
This facility has helped me. I am now better. I was very sick. I was not able to walk on my own. I was vomiting and had diarrhea. Now there is no vomiting and diarrhea.
Winston Mulanda, the deputy medical coordinator for MSF Holland in South Sudan, says the strategy of bringing cholera treatment close to where the most vulnerable citizens live is critically important.
We have to pass the message to the community, and as soon as possible, they can reach the CTC, that the most important things, and then we don't lose time. Because when you are dealing with cholera patients, time is really important.
Mulanda says the Munuki Center has a 150-bed capacity and several qualified nurses. He says individuals must be vigilant about drinking only clean and chlorinated water to prevent the disease from spreading. Juba, like other major towns in South Sudan, does not have pipe water in all of its suburbs. John Zero, a resident of Juba's Kirkat suburb, says he follows a strict personal hygiene routine of washing his hands with soap and water every time after using the toilet and before eating. Zero says he and his family also make sure their cooking utensils are clean.
Exactly where I stay, there are no cases of cholera reported. The only places where I can hear it of is places like Gumbo.
Kirkat, like Gumbo, is at the eastern bank of the River Nile and near the Juba Numili Road. Zero says there is no pipe water in either of the two neighborhoods. He thinks Kirkat residents are lucky not to have a single documented case of cholera since the outbreak was confirmed.
Maybe God is just giving us some chances, but I don't think it's really clear.
Cholera outbreaks are not uncommon in South Sudan. Last year, 167 people died from cholera. Mulanda says the lower numbers this year could be attributed to less rainfall. For VOA News, I am Philip Tonalew in Juba.
Human rights groups are putting new pressure on Senegal to change their abortion laws after a United Nations Committee of Experts recently recommended the Western African country decriminalize abortion in cases of rape, incest, and threat to life of the mother. Daisy Smith is a program officer for women's rights at the International Federation for Human Rights. She tells Ricky Shryock that 19% of women inmates in Senegal are imprisoned because of infanticide, often a result of their inability to obtain an abortion.
We found out that because of the prohibition of abortion, women get illegal and unsafe abortions. There's around 50,000 illegal and unsafe abortions every year. Women risk up to 2 years imprisonment and a fine if they get an abortion illegally. And some women are pushed to actually kill their babies and commit infanticide. And it also causes dramatic consequences on the health of women who couldn't get abortion, especially for victims of rape and little girls.
Have you guys seen an increase in your research in infanticide? I mean, how often did you see this happening? What was the rate?
I don't know exactly what is the rate, but the numbers we have is that 19% of the women who are imprisoned are detained on charges of infanticide. And 3% on charges of clandestine abortion.
The law as it stands in Senegal right now is that abortion is 100% illegal in all cases, correct? There are no exceptions for rape or incest.
No, there's no exception for rape or incest, but in theory, women can get abortions if their life can only be saved by this procedure, but they have to get the approval of three doctors. So in practice, it never happens.
I imagine the expense alone of getting the approval of three doctors would mean it's prohibitive for quite a few women.
Yeah. And four women in Senegal are lucky to see one doctor in their lifetimes.
Who are you working with in the government? Who are the local NGOs working with within the government to try and make this happen? And how likely is it to actually, you know, is it being debated right now? Or
yes, one of our members and the Association des Femmes Juristes Sénégalaises are members of this task force. It was set up by the Ministry of Health, and they are working on a reform. And if the reform is passed, abortion could be legal in cases of rape and incest, but not if the woman's health is at risk.
What's the average sentence they are carrying out? How many years for abortion?
It's two years of imprisonment and a fine.
2 years of imprisonment if you're found guilty of abortion.
Yeah. It was a big success that the city committee issued a recommendation on abortion, because in 1994, when the CEDAW committee reviewed the Senegal for the last time, it didn't issue any recommendation on abortion, so it's a step forward.
That was Daisy Schmidt, program officer for women's rights. She was speaking to Ricky Shryock from Paris. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Pierre Nkurunziza was sworn in for a third term as president of Burundi on August 20th, following a deeply flawed electoral process and his decision to run for a third term. The president called for reconciliation and an end to the increasing violence that has sent 200,000 of his fellow citizens fleeing to neighboring nations. But the crisis, sparked by Nkurunziza's decision to run for office again in violation of the Arusha Agreement that has anchored Burundi's stability since the end of the civil war, isn't over. The president wants Burundians to unite and those who left to return to help rebuild the nation, but the situation remains volatile. His ability to effectively govern the country is in peril as Burundi struggles with the continued aftermath of a flawed election, the closure of democratic space, a rapidly declining economy, and increasing violence. The United States believes that without a government that represents the population's many political voices, and without a comprehensive and inclusive dialogue, an inauguration won't resolve the nation's political and security crisis. An inclusive and comprehensive political dialogue is the only credible route to reestablish stability in Burundi and forge consensus and a peaceful path forward for its people. Such a dialogue could begin to restore democratic credibility to the country by reaffirming the Arusha Agreement, reopening press outlets, releasing political prisoners, and reaching agreement on an electoral process going forward. The United States supports the effort of Uganda on behalf of the East African community to mediate this dialogue and believes that continued attention and support from the African Union, United Nations, and all states in the region will be critical to help bring Burundi back from the precipice.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 1730 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at UpfrontAfrica.